Welcome to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. 12-year-old Esther is a rape victim in Liberia. Now there's a way to protect her identity when she testifies in court.
I see her face. Only her back was turned to me.
I didn't see her face. Only her back, she says. I felt happy. I rejoiced in my heart because my daughter was not exposed. No one would know who she is.
And selling carnations in Cairo. One man has worked the same corner for 20 years. American Idol judge Simon Cowell does something nice for a change. He's produced a hit song to benefit Haiti. Around the world with the World Vision Report. Stay with us. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. A study out this week shows that joblessness among low-income workers has reached a staggering 30%. So it's no surprise that the number of homeless is rising, too. And that includes children. In Los Angeles, thousands of homeless kids shuffle between shelters, cars, and streets. And that means it can be a struggle to stay in school. A nonprofit group called Schools on Wheels is making sure the kids learn their three R's wherever they are. Eve Tro reports.
When Agnes Stevens retired after more than 30 years teaching public school, she knew what she wanted to do next. She wanted to tutor homeless children. But
of course, the shelters didn't know me and I didn't know them, and I was getting a little, you know, how am I going to find a kid to help?
So Stevens took a part-time job at a public school close to a homeless shelter. One Friday, two brothers came into her office to sign up for sixth grade and fourth grade.
They each told me they wanted to learn how to read. Then I looked at their records, and they had been traveling around the country with their grandmother. And I remember that weekend, I was trying to line up different volunteers, and I was all excited, pulling out books, getting lesson plans and all. And, well, you know what happened. On Monday, they were gone.
No phone number, no explanation, just gone. Stevens was devastated and determined to do better. She realized a bricks-and-mortar school couldn't serve homeless kids constantly on the move. So in 1993, she created School on Wheels to get them what they needed, no matter where they landed.
I thought of an 800 number, a backpack and school supplies, and your own tutor.
No, that's right. Reputation. The T is basically silent. There you go.
At the organization's downtown learning center, students get one-on-one attention. 10-year-old Steven works with his tutor on some big words.
I have to find synonyms and antonyms on my vocabulary words. Identity, novel, groundwork.
The center is a bright spot on LA's Skid Row, literally. Its big yellow sign is the most cheerful thing on the block. The inside looks like a tidy classroom with computers, books, toys, and kids' artwork on the walls. This building is a hub for the Wheels part of the organization. From here, program leader Matt Robb coordinates volunteers who fan out across the city to tutor homeless children, about 3,000 of them last year. Robb says the tutors are often the most consistent thing in these kids' lives. That includes the 7-year-old he works with, Josias.
His family moved around in the past 4 years. They probably lived in 20 different places, in shelters, motels. Unfortunately, the children in the family were taken away from their mother, so they were put in foster care, and from there they moved from foster home to foster home to foster home. But my student's the most amazing kid, and I can't believe that he's been through what he's been through, and smiling and, you know, working hard in school.
At 5 o'clock, the Learning Center closes. This is when much of School on Wheels work begins. Volunteers meet with kids in public libraries, parks, and even in homeless shelters, like the Union Rescue Mission. It's across the street from the Learning Center, and that's where 14-year-old Miranda Session lives. She's from Seattle.
I stay here with my dad and my little sister. We caught the Greyhound from there to here, and then we found out a shelter that was nearby, you know. That was maybe like a year ago.
They've bounced around a few shelters ever since. Miranda says she made straight A's in Seattle. Here, her grades have slipped. So she signed up for a tutor from School on Wheels, and she got Megan Collins, a petite blonde who works as an office manager. Miranda says she met Megan about 6 months ago.
You can tell she's exciting, she's fun, she's intelligent, and she's experienced with the kids. So
she was smiling from ear to ear. She seemed really excited to see like that, see how she smiles like that. she has a great smile, which made me very excited because I knew that this wasn't something that someone was making her do.
Megan quickly saw the root of Miranda's low grades. She wasn't getting to school.
So many days I missed from not having enough bus tokens, or my dad gets sick and he can't take us down to the bus stop. He doesn't feel that it's safe enough for us to walk on our own.
I got in touch with her teachers, some of which were very, very helpful, some of which weren't as helpful. I started getting emails from them telling me what she had missed, and so we started spending more time to sort of catch that stuff up.
The teachers didn't know Miranda was homeless. Her classmates still don't. Megan says her tutoring work has been a bit of a struggle. It's been years since she touched these subjects. So her iPhone comes in handy.
We Googled algebra, and we figured it out. We sat here a long time that night, didn't we?
Megan's helped Miranda set a goal for the new year, to go a whole month without missing school.
I plan on doing it.
I'm glad you do. I plan on supporting you.
Later, Megan tells me she's not sure Miranda will make her goal. There are so many obstacles, and the family is already talking about moving again. But Megan says any time and any place Miranda wants to learn, she's willing to pick up where they left off.
I like the book so far. I'm almost finished.
Are you almost finished?
For the World Vision Report,
wow.
I'm Eve Tro in Los Angeles.
I'm starting to learn how to read faster. You know?
I told you, the more that you read, even if it's stuff, it doesn't have to be for school, but the more that you read, the easier it will be to read, especially when school starts again and you have to read boring stuff.
Reporting in Afghanistan is tough, and not just because of the war and the rough terrain. Our reporter, Will Everett, has been on several assignments in Afghanistan. He told us what it was like traveling on dangerous, dusty roads, trying to find a room for the night. Here's his reporter's notebook.
For foreign aid workers and other expatriates in Afghanistan, the choice in accommodations is usually a guest house operated by the UN or other aid organizations. But most of them won't accept Afghan guests. My friend Anwar, an Afghan who was acting as my translator, warned me about this, but I made the calls anyway. They didn't exactly say no Afghans allowed, but each time I gave the guesthouse employee our names, there was an awkward silence, followed by the apologetic discovery that, alas, there was no room at the inn. These guesthouses provide the sort of comforts you don't find at your standard Afghan hotel. Hot water, Western cooking, hot tubs, and of course, alcohol. You'd think that a Muslim traveler could make up his or her own mind about the question of alcohol, but the guest houses take no chances. Rather than offend Muslim sensibilities, they find it easier just to keep all Afghans out. We were driving from Kabul to Mazar-i-Sharif in the northern part of the country. Once we were within cell phone range of the city, I began calling the guest houses. Yes, they said, we have plenty of rooms. But when we arrived at the walled compounds and the porters saw Anwar, the situation changed.
He's got to get the manager to let us in?
Yes. Let's see what's manager.
Yeah.
Sometimes the manager was unavailable, like at this guest house, where the porter spoke to us as he was closing the creaking iron gate.
I'm so sorry, son. They are sleeping and I can't disturb them.
They're sleeping?
Yes.
Oh. Well, what time do they wake up?
I don't know. Okay, here
other times the rooms had mysteriously become unavailable.
We're here to stay in the guest house.
Sorry, sir, we have no room.
No rooms?
Why?
No, we called earlier and we were told that there were rooms.
I felt bad for Anwar. I wondered if this is what it felt like in another time when a black person was told to find another restroom, water fountain, or hotel. I consulted a copy of Lonely Planet and asked Anwar to call up an Afghan hotel. It was only $5 a night. We wouldn't have a hot tub, but at this point a meal and a place to sleep were all we cared about. The hotel was as run down as the guidebook promised. The power was out, and the manager looked at me curiously from behind his lantern. "You didn't say you were bringing a foreigner," he muttered to Anwar. As it happened, he didn't have any more $5 rooms, but he'd be happy to offer us one. For $50. I caught Anwar's smile and realized that the knife of segregation cuts both ways. One of us had been denied a room. The other had been offered a room, but at 10 times the going price. I never got to experience the luxuries of the guest house. Instead, I slept and ate on floors, dressed like an Afghan, and picked up bits and pieces of the language. There's quite a bit you can learn from an Afghan, if you're willing to live like one. Segregation, oddly enough, made that possible.
Will Everett is a freelance producer based in Texas. Now, this week's Globe at a Glance. Economists at the Inter-American Development Bank say it could cost $14 billion to rebuild Haiti. That makes the Haitian earthquake the most destructive natural disaster in modern times. Millions of dollars in aid have already been raised for Haiti. And now, not one, but two songs have been released to help in the fundraising efforts. But if you just remember that? It's We Are the World, written by Michael Jackson and Lionel Richie. They recorded it in 1985 to raise money for famine relief in Ethiopia. It turned out to be the best-selling single hit of all time, raising more than $63 million. We can't let them suffer. No, we cannot. Fast forward 25 years, and this is what you'll hear. They need a helping hand. It's a remake of the original. The music video debuted at the opening of the Winter Olympics in Vancouver last week. All profits from the new song will go to Haiti earthquake relief. And on the other side of the pond, American Idol judge Simon Cowell put together a star-studded cover of R.E.M.'s Everybody Hurts. The song is at the top of the charts in England for the second week in a row. All proceeds from the sale of this single will also go to help Haiti. That's our Globe at a Glance this week. I'm Peggy Waymire. There's more ahead on the World Vision Report. Stay with us. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. During Liberia's brutal civil war in the 1990s, soldiers used rape as a weapon. Almost 70% of Liberian women were sexually assaulted. Rape continues to be rampant in Liberia, and it's a crime that usually goes unpunished. President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, Africa's first female president, has made it a top priority to stop the epidemic of rape in Liberia. And one of the ways that's happening is through Court E. Gina Moore explains.
When 12-year-old Esther comes to the prosecutor's office, she goes straight for the toys. She winds up a clock, gently touches a Barbie, and takes stock of other offerings. She settles on the singing Cabbage Patch doll, cradling it as she hums. The room is practically a toy box and reflects a shocking reality. Most of the reported rapes in Monrovia are committed against children. Esther is one of the victims. 3 years ago, she was raped by her uncle. We've changed her name to protect her identity. Esther's mother, Naomi, doesn't want her daughter to go through the pain of public exposure again.
Each time my daughter playing with people, they will chop her. Hey, move on, yeah.
When my daughter plays outside, people, they say, you have to get away. You're not a girl anymore. And my daughter cries when this happens. Naomi's daughter also endured taunts in the courtroom, the very place Naomi thought was going to protect her. They put my daughter on the stand for everyone to look at her, to mock her, to her face. People were saying, that child was raped? Now she's a real woman. In that case, Esther's rapist was found not guilty, but the appeal moved to a special courtroom. It's called Court E. Magisterial courts are labeled by letters instead of by numbers in Liberia, and it's the new home for all rape cases in Monserrato County, where the capital sits. Liberia's President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf pushed for the court.
This was a direct response to a situation in which rape was very rampant in the country, and we found so many young girls, sometimes children, very young children, you know, being subjected to this. And so we felt we had to have a court that was dedicated, you know, solely to crimes against women.
In Court E, a court reporter taps out a verbatim record of trial proceedings. It's the only note-taking allowed in the court, which prioritizes confidentiality. No one is allowed even to watch the proceedings without the judge's permission. In a conventional courtroom in Liberia, the name of the victim is routinely revealed. That's never the case in Court E, where even the victim's face is protected. She testifies in a separate room, speaking into a microphone, with her back to a TV camera. Prosecutor George Sagbe stands in that room and describes how the court proceedings work.
What we do is that we do our best to ensure that no one else sees the witness as she comes in here. When she comes in here, then the defendant is brought to court. By the time she arrives and she's about to testify, then the camera is set. As soon as the defendant is identified by the witness, the camera is turned off.
Naomi remembers the day her daughter Esther sat in this room and testified.
I see her face. When her back was turned to me, I was feeling fine.
I didn't see her face, only her back, she says. I felt happy. I rejoiced in my heart because my daughter was not exposed. No one would know who she is. For all its ingenuity, Court E is far from perfect. It's been bogged down by a learning curve and by investigation challenges. Since April, 136 cases have come its way, but prosecutors have tried only three of them. They've won two. One of those was Esther's. Her rapist went to jail for life. 3 days after that verdict, Esther's new brother was born. The name his mother chose for him? Justice. For the World Vision Report, I'm Gina Moore in Monrovia, Liberia.
This story was made possible with support from the Pulitzer Center for Crisis Reporting. Author William Powers lived in Liberia for 2 years. He was an aid worker, directing relief programs during the Civil War there. When Powers returned to the country years later on a different assignment, he met up with his former house cleaner, whose life had changed dramatically. Here's William Powers' aid worker diary.
My former house cleaner, Harris Johnson, wants to do the dishes. But I slide the sponge out of his hand and plunge it into the suds. "Boss man," he exclaims, using a common term here that's delivered remarkably without any irony. "Please give me that sponge." Harris, an earnest 35-year-old, did my dishes from 1999 to 2001. I hold tight to the sponge and start scrubbing. And Harris goes back to what he'd been doing earlier, scrubbing a virus out of my laptop. When I left Liberia 7 years ago, Harris was illiterate. But he worked hard to transform himself into a Microsoft-certified network technician. An angel paid for his education. That angel was my mother. She met Harris while visiting me in Liberia during a Christmas holiday. For 7 years, she has sent much of her Social Security check to Liberia to pay for Harris's education. And since tuition in Liberia is just a fraction of what it is in the U.S., she's able to help many others, including Barzai Moore. Barzai was a janitor with my aid group when my mother met him. She was impressed that Barzai stayed late, hours after he'd finished cleaning the toilets, to teach himself about spreadsheets on a dusty computer in the back of the office. She offered him a full scholarship at Liberia's top school, Cuttington University. Barzai surprised everyone, except my mother. The former janitor graduated at the top of his class and works today as an accountant. He uses part of his salary each month to help younger Liberians pay their school fees. The Americos, the freed American slaves who settled Liberia in the 1800s, didn't always want their slightly darker-skinned, African-born compatriots to get too much education. That's because, in high irony, they used them as slaves on their plantations, imitating the model of their former white masters in the antebellum South. They feared that more education would mean less cheap labor. Today, Liberia's president, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, is a champion of education. She issued an executive order making primary education free and compulsory. But she lacks the funds to carry out her order. Money, as they say here, is small. Money is small for my mom these days, too. But that hasn't stopped her. In spite of the economic downturn, she's taken on two additional students. So Olma, as she's now known in Liberia, skips the latte and often bikes around her hometown in North Carolina instead of paying at the pump to drive a car. But these are small sacrifices when it comes to transforming a life. Of course, my self-effacing mother wouldn't phrase it like that. I suspect she feels exactly the way the Liberian graduates do. They always tell me, God is helping us through your Olma. Back in the kitchen, I've washed the last dish. My computer is scrubbed clean, too. Your mother is my mother, too, Harris says to me, in a lilting English laced with the cadence of the 19th century American South. That means we are brothers.
William Powers is author of the Liberia memoir, Blue Clay People. He has a new book coming out in May. It's called 12 by 12. You can find out more on our website, worldvisionreport.org. This week, members of the UN Human Rights Council urged Iraq to clean up its dismal human rights record. This comes on the heels of news that several Christians have been killed in the lead-up to parliamentary elections in March. Attacks on religious or ethnic groups in Iraq are often reported in the media. But there's another minority group being targeted, and it's one you might not have heard much about. Matthew McAllister reported for New York Magazine on the persecution of gay Iraqis.
There was no one more hated, and is no one more hated and completely undefended, really, in Iraq than its gay population. And the strong sense from many of the people targeted was that this was mainly the Mahdi army, that's the Shia militia run by the radical cleric Muqtada al-Sadr.
How is it different for gays and lesbians in Iraq than it is for other groups that some of the Muslim extremists hate?
It's different because women have women and have representatives in government and NGOs and the backing of the State Department and all sorts of networks and support systems. Christians have the same. Kurds have the same. Every minority you can think of in Iraq has a support network, has each other. Gay people in Iraq don't even know each other for the large part, and they don't even trust each other because if they were revealed as gay, then they would be subject to exposure possibly and torture and killing, even by members of their own family. So it is a uniquely, and I was struck by this. I mean, I worked a lot in Iraq, and it sort of suddenly occurred to me, yeah, they are uniquely exposed and undefended.
Can you tell us what you heard from them and maybe a few of their stories of what they've been through?
These are men who are currently living in a city outside of Iraq in the Middle East where it's relatively safe for them. And they have essentially escaped their own country because of this persecution. And they are dealing in their own separate ways with the trauma that they've been through. And there was an older man, 42 years old. Most of these men are quite young. This older man whose sort of fake name, I have to protect his identity, is Sammy, had been abducted, he believes, by the Mahdi army from his mobile phone store in Baghdad and beaten and raped. And then ultimately ransomed. His family managed to get ransom money together. He was given a chance to live, which many of them are not. And he at that point thought, you know, it's time to go. And so he escaped with the help of Human Rights Watch. There are other shocking stories. A young man named Fadi, again, not his real name, two of his closest friends, gay friends, were found dead in the streets. They'd both obviously been tortured before being shot in the head.
And so what has Human Rights Watch in the U.S. done to try to rescue and help these men?
Scott Long, who heads up that part of Human Rights Watch, has been dealing with these issues for many years in many countries. I think it was April the 1st, Scott Long first had his first direct contact with one of these young men inside Iraq. And after that conversation, and this young man was terrified and had himself been tortured, Scott basically decided that he had to do something about it. And Human Rights Watch and NGOs in general, aid agencies, do not extract people from their home countries. And that's what he did. Scott Long and a few other people started identifying these young men who were being persecuted, and through the internet, actually, they placed a lot of a lot of notices on Personal's gay site called manjam.com. And these were young Iraqi men who were out looking to meet people. And suddenly in their inbox would be these messages from this group in New York saying, you know, are you being targeted? You know, we may be able to help. And then Human Rights Watch started these conversations with these young guys and started wiring them money through Western Union for plane tickets and to get them out.
Now that Human Rights Watch has called attention to this in the American media, and certainly your article has in Newark Magazine, I'm wondering if there's any action being taken in Iraq by the government to do something about this.
The State Department have made approaches to the Iraqi government about this issue. So the Iraqi government has been feeling some pressure. From what I understand, the abductions have very much fallen off as a consequence of this attention that they received. And that, in fact, one of Muqtada al-Sadr's spokesman gave an interview a while ago saying that while Muqtada al-Sadr believed that homosexuality was something awful and had to be fought against, he did not believe in killing homosexuals. And that seemed to some extent stem the flow of violence against gay people in Iraq. The concern, I think, now is that the conditions are always there for it to rear its head again in a same sort of opportunistic way.
Matt McAllister, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Matthew McAllister is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter based in New York. Now we go to Cairo. It's one of the noisiest cities in the Middle East. There's the nonstop car traffic, the calls to prayer blasting through loudspeakers, and salesmen hawking their wares in the marketplace. And in the middle of all this bustle, there's Khaled. Daniel Estrin introduces us to the flower seller in this installment of our Street Vendor series.
There's nothing quite like shopping in a Middle Eastern bazaar. The spices, the smells, the shimmering scarves that are real, genuine, 100% silk, really one of a kind. And look, it brings out the color in your eyes. They're usually a fortune, but for you, my dear, I'll give you a very special price. And before you can get a word in edgewise, the scarves are in your bag. Shopping in the Middle East is not always a pleasant experience, until you meet Khaled.
I'm Khaled.
I'm 42 years old. I've been working with flowers for 20 years. What would you like to drink?
First rule of Middle Eastern marketplace etiquette: when the salesman fetches you tea, you're trapped. But this was different. Khaled wasn't trying to sell me anything. He actually took a few minutes off work to sit in a coffee house and chat. It's rare for Khaled to take a break, Every evening, for 4 hours, he walks up and down this busy intersection with a bundle of dyed carnations in his arms. But he doesn't charge a fixed price. That's not that unusual in the Middle East, but Khaled doesn't even haggle. That's basically unheard of here. Sometimes a driver at the traffic light will pay him 20 cents for a flower, sometimes a few dollars. Regardless, Khaled just smiles.
It's true. People like my smile. I dress well. I keep my hair nice.
Khaled makes about $10 a day selling his flowers. He says it's enough to keep his 3 girls in school. He could make around the same money working, say, in a bank. But Khaled says he enjoys his work.
I love flowers. I've always loved flowers. I could be a bank teller, but I wouldn't be happy because it's not the job I like. That's why I do this job. I give 100% and I like my job.
No, he's not annoying you like other people. Please, I want the money, Shafi. He will smile to you and, you know, his smile grabs you to buy from him flowers.
That's 18-year-old Saif Minshawi. He stopped at the intersection and rolled down his window to talk.
My mother told me when she was young that she saw him standing in this street.
That's because Khaled has worked this same intersection for 20 years. And Minshawi sometimes buys flowers from him.
Do you talk to him a little bit? Sometimes you talk to him?
No.
You never have a conversation?
No. Never.
Just hi, how are you?
Hi, how are you? Thank you so much. Thank you for the flowers.
Just enough conversation to fill the time before the light turns green. You might be able to hear a bit of nerves in Khaled's voice as he sips tea with me. He's talking fast, almost tripping over his words. Unlike the slick salesman of the bazaars, Khaled isn't used to chit-chat. I thanked Khaled for the interview. He grabbed a glass of water and splashed his flowers to freshen them up. Then he hopped to his feet, flashed a smile, and returned to work. For the World Vision Report, I'm Daniel Estrin in Cairo.
Coming up, forget the packets of powdered hot chocolate. Learn how to make the real thing next on the World Vision Report. Stay with us. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. You might have had your fill of chocolate last week on Valentine's Day, but in Oaxaca, Mexico, people eat chocolate every day. That's not so surprising, since Mexico is the birthplace of chocolate. We wanted to know how Mexicans make their delicious hot chocolate, or chocolate atole. So we sent reporter Mary Stuckey to meet Chef Pilar Cabrera. She's known for making the meanest chocolate atole in the region. They started on a busy street in the center of town, where the air is rich with the smell of chocolate.
We're at Chocolate Mayordomo, one of the very first chocolate stores to open in Oaxaca. We're buying the raw ingredients for chocolate atole, perhaps the most popular form of hot chocolate in Mexico.
And here we stop in the first place and start the business of chocolate in Oaxaca, Chocolate Mayordomo. Here we have in front of us have cacao, cinnamon, almonds, and sugar. I prefer more proportion of almonds and less sugar. This is the flavor I learned from my grandmom. Me puedes vender media molienda de este.
Okay, so she is putting these cacao beans, all like big coffee beans, really, on an old-fashioned scale and weighing them in a big metal dish. After we buy the ingredients, we cross the street to where the grinders are. About half a dozen work in one huge shop whose doors are open to the busy street. Ancient grinding machines pulverize the cacao beans, almonds, sugar, and cinnamon. And then men mix the ingredients into a paste by hand using a knife. Now, even though we have the chocolate paste flavored with almond, cinnamon, and sugar, we're not going to make our own chocolate atole today. Instead, we'll take a short taxi ride to the market to join in a morning ritual in Oaxaca. This market is right next door to the school Pilar attended as a child.
we come into the market almost every day. Yeah, and for me, my best place is Comedor Mari. They prepare the best chocolate we have here in the city. We call chocolate atole. Doña Mari, venimos a visitarla.
Pilar greets the proprietor, Maria Ramirez Vasquez. The 70-year-old, wearing an apron and long braids, stands in front of a huge pot. Inside, dried corn is boiling in water. This is the corn atole, the base ingredient in the hot chocolate drink.
People cook the corn, dry corn, one day in advance. And this water, thick atole, because boiling, and at the end combined with the chocolate, without almonds, and a lot of cinnamon.
But there's a special way in which the thick corn and the chocolate are combined.
And use the molinillo to bring foamy on the top of the chocolate.
The molinillo is a foot-long wooden whisk. It's a lot of work to use it. There's no milk in this drink, but even without it, Maria whips up a substantial foam. The foam is said to contain the energy of the person who made the drink. That person must be a woman, whose worth as a cook is determined by how much foam she can create. Maria tells Pilar she makes 30 liters of chocolate atole every day to sell in the market. That's a lot of whisking.
At the end, serve in a big bowl with a wooden spoon. We stir the mixture, and then we're drinking, and I feel the delicious flavor of the chocolate, and the combination with the corn atole is great. Do you want to try it?
Nothing like our hot chocolate. It's completely different. This isn't so sweet. Yeah. And no milk in this.
No milk. Doña Mari, nos vemos.
Time to go. Chocolate atole is a breakfast drink, and the morning is passing. As we leave, we spot two schoolgirls, heads bent over huge bowls of Doña Maria's hot chocolate.
Bebe chocolate cada día?
Sí.
The girls say they start each day with a bowl of chocolate atole, just like countless generations before them. For the World Vision Report, I'm Mary Stuckey in Oaxaca, Mexico.
If chocolate is number one in Oaxaca, music's not far behind. Here's what people are listening to this week. It's Contigo Estaré by Moenia. Remember what you did with that gift card you got for Christmas? Or how about that really generous one you got for your birthday? If you haven't used them yet, you're not alone. More than $8 billion worth of gift cards are given away every year, but thousands of people never even use them. They tuck them away into their wallets and pockets. And that gave Jeff Schinnebarger an idea.
My wife and I got married about 5 years ago, and after our wedding, we had a stack of gift cards because we ran out of things to buy from Bed Bath & Beyond and Target. And it took us about a year to get through them. And we said, I wonder how many other people are like us. So one day at a wedding, we were with eight strangers, and I decided to test my theory out. And I asked them all, I said, how many of you have a gift card in your wallet or your purse that has been sitting there for longer than 6 months? And they kind of started pulling them out of their purse, and they all pulled out a total of about $50 in gift cards. And I said,
why don't you give those to me and I'll do something good with them? I'll give them to someone in need. So that's how giftcardgiver.com got started.
People just coughed them up, huh?
Yeah, it's kind of funny. Most people don't actually view gift cards the same as a dollar amount. It's kind of unique.
Yeah, I have to confess, I'm sitting here visualizing my desk drawer where I have a few gift cards from years back stuffed in there. I hate to total it up. I wonder why it is we don't see these gift cards as cash, because they're worth a lot of money.
That's exactly it. And the funny thing is, we feel like it's a new form of giving. There's annually about $8 billion not used in gift cards. And we think we can do incredible things for people in need with that money.
So what do you do for people in need? How do you do this? You collect the gift cards. And where are you sending the gift cards?
We have had tons of projects. You can imagine the amount of gift cards we get ranges from a gift card from Starbucks to Burger King to Wendy's to Gap to Kroger's. Every brand you could ever imagine we've received a gift card from. So what we have to do is we have this large filing system. It really is with boxes from baseball card collectors that we organize these with based on company. And when we get one company, usually roughly between $300 to $500 in gift cards, we'll find a project specifically that is relatable to that brand. Every Christmas, we give many, many toys away to kids. We got a call 2 days before Christmas, and it was a single mother that had her house broken into and lost all the Christmas presents she had bought for her five kids. And we were, in the matter of 24 hours, able to replace every Christmas present for their kids, get them a new Christmas tree, and give them $200 in groceries.
All with gift cards?
Yeah, it was really fast. All with gift cards, yep.
So you don't stack up the gift cards with a rubber band around them and send the gift cards to the people to shop for themselves. You actually use the gift cards, shop for the people with the gift cards, and send them real products.
Yeah, it depends on the project and where the location is. That was a local story. So there's another organization and a project called Laundry Love on the West Coast. And they go in and wash clothes for people that are homeless in a laundromat. So we decided to send them about $500 in gift cards from Starbucks. So while the laundry was waiting, they took all these people with dignity and let them order whatever they want. And one really cool story that happened last August was we heard about a school in Atlanta Public Schools, an elementary school, where a bunch of the kids living in the urban context couldn't afford back-to-school supplies. And we were able to provide 400 kids with backpacks full of school supplies.
So people shouldn't think that if they even have a $10 gift card from Macy's or Kroger's or whatever, that it's small change. Because when you add it up and put a few of those together, you can really provide a nice gift for somebody.
Absolutely. We've received gift cards with one penny on them before, and we've received a $96 gift card to Ruth Chris. The gift card we get the most is a Starbucks gift card, to be honest with you. And it's usually about, I think it's $1.32 that's left on it. It's one latte, you know,
that's
grande.
That's not even a latte, Jeff. No. I don't know what you can get for $1.32.
It's usually a $5 gift card someone's received, and they've bought one latte, and they have $1.32 left, and they usually give that to us.
Well, that would work for you. If you got 20 of those, you'd have a lot.
We have gotten a lot of Starbucks cards, many, many. Whatever the level of money is on it, it doesn't matter. It works just like a change drive would in other ways. We have the ability to collect those, put them together, and then help people that can really use them.
About how much have you given away so far in gift cards?
Yeah, well, we've collected over $25,000 in gift cards. We've given away over $10,000 of that so far.
So if I have an unused gift card, which I do, that I want to give away to someone in need, how would I do that?
Well, we have a website. It's called giftcardgiver.com. And we ask people to just find out how much is left on that gift card. It could be 37 cents, could be $3.21. Just write on the card with a marker in some way, and then send it to us. We have our address online, and we'll collect it and do something great with it. We promise.
All right. Jeff Schinnebarger, thank you so much for joining us today.
Great talking to you. And it sounds like you have some gift cards you need to send to giftcardgiver.com.
I do. I'll go online and look that up.
Thank you so much, Peggy. Thanks for including me.
Jeff Schinnebarger is founder of GiftCardGiver.com. He spoke to us from Atlanta. Next season's fashions were rolled out in New York City this week. You may not be buying the leather leggings, but you may want to toss some of those old jeans and t-shirts that have gone out of style. If you do, you might be heading to the Salvation Army or Goodwill. But your clothes won't necessarily be donated to poor people. Most of them, in fact, are going to a big business in Africa. Suzanne Marmion reports from Malawi.
It's peak season for clothes shopping in the city of Blantyre. The crops have been harvested, and many people here have a little cash to spare. They often spend it at this used clothing market. Pressed trousers hang from fence railings. Brightly colored children's clothes catch the eye, including a dress printed with the American flag. Johannes Kampiri is a father of six. He's bargaining for a pair of Spider-Man underpants for one of his sons. He throws in two more items of clothing and seals the deal for just under $3.
It's a nice price, indeed.
Maybe not so nice, considering that most people in Malawi survive on less than $1 a day. These clothes were once actually free. People in the West donated them to charity. This comes as a shock to the woman who just sold the clothes to Kampiri. Speaking through a translator, Alice Basio says she had to buy the donated clothes from wholesalers. Now she thinks the wholesalers should have passed the clothes along as donations.
She thinks it's good for them to give it free because selling is not good for something given for free.
Is it expensive for you to buy the clothes to sell?
Yes.
Americans supply most of these clothes to charities like Goodwill, which are overwhelmed with donations. The organizations then sell off most of the clothes for a few pennies a pound. Shippers lug them away in cargo containers, typically bound for Africa. Wholesalers buy them on the docks and then truck the clothes to warehouses, like this one in Blantyre. Here, workers sort through mountains of cast-offs. White clothes are separated out. They're worth less because they're too hard to keep clean. After sorting, workers use a press to bale the clothes in plastic. The used clothes business in Africa has even spawned its own vocabulary. Malawians have a term in the Chichewa language for the garments. It translates as clothes that spill out of a bale into a pile you have to sort through.
We call it kaunjika.
Arobe Lakadala is the quality control manager for this warehouse. She's wearing kaunjika, a baggy red t-shirt with a Puma logo. Lakadala says she knows these clothes were initially donated, but she has no qualms about charging for them.
We need to sell them so that we should find money to pay those who are working.
The employees here work for an organization called Development Aid From People to People, or DAP. It used to give away clothes in the region, but Ulla Thompson, who runs DAP in Malawi, says some African governments asked it to stop.
They were reasoning that you create dependency and it's better that you create development. And people can actually feel proud of having earned a living by doing this job. And there's no one who gives out clothes for free. It doesn't exist anymore.
Still, selling the clothes means that the poorest people can't afford them. The very people donors in America may have thought they were helping. The used clothing industry in general does help Malawi. It brings tax revenues, provides a low-cost product, and it generates jobs. But studies show the industry has eliminated more jobs than it's created. This is one of the last textile factories left in Malawi. Rows of workers are busy stitching together t-shirts. Since most people here can't afford to buy clothes new, these t-shirts are bound for the United States. Kandalal Desai represents Malawi's Garment and Textile Manufacturers Association. He also owns this factory.
You can see the number of people who are employed here. And the objective here is more and more employment.
But that's not likely to happen. Desai says the used clothing trade has cut into his business. Before used clothing flooded the country, people did buy one or two new items per year, but no more. So to survive, Desai has had to cut costs. For instance, he now imports the cotton fabric for the t-shirts.
I could be producing this fabric within Malawi from Malawi cotton. Now this one is coming from China. The fabric is coming from China.
Some African countries have banned used clothing imports to protect their domestic industry, but smugglers still supply the many Africans who depend on the cheaper used clothes. Even the textile workers here buy them, including Esnet Nkwazalamba. She's busy cutting strips of green lace to trim a t-shirt that she and her co-workers could never afford to buy new.
No, we cannot manage to buy those things.
So she buys used clothes instead, even though she knows they could ultimately put her out of a job. For the World Vision Report, I'm Suzanne Marmion, Blantyre, Malawi.
And that's it for this week. Remember, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and on the web at worldvisionreport.org. There are photographs and blogs from our reporters across the globe. Beverly Abel produces the show, and the editor is Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Sue Shepherd are our producers. Doug Boyles is our engineer. Emily Eagle is our engineering assistant. Chris Baldiga is our production assistant. And I'm Peggy Waymire. Please join us again next week.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.
Cause I didn't need pizza, but never I'm with.